been a while since I preach. And in this case, can you turn up the mic a little bit, please? In this case, I had the opportunity of being able to attend a series of seminars that was given by Dr. Charles Price. He's the head pastor of Toronto's People's Church in Toronto, Ontario. And he inspired me with a number of different messages that he shared. And I also had the opportunity of being able to read some of his books and the opportunity to chat with him. And so in part, this message that you're going to be hearing this morning is a message that he had also shared with me on a previous occasion. And the theme I want to address today is the theme of beyond superficiality. How do we maintain our spiritual reality with God? And we're going to be looking into the book of 1 Samuel. And we find in this book that there are many, many illustrations of people who, with the best of intentions, find themselves sliding away spiritually from true intimacy with God, from true dependence on God, from true experience of God, and they are left with an outward shell that still looks right and it looks orthodox, but in fact, it's actually dead and dissatisfying. Now, I'm going to be reading to you from 1 Samuel chapter 4, and I'm going to start with just the first four verses. Now, the Israelites went out to fight against the Philistines. The Israelites camped at Ebenezer and the Philistines at Aphek. The Philistines deployed their forces to meet Israel, and as the battle spread, Israel was defeated by the Philistines, who killed about 4,000 of them on the battlefield. When the soldiers returned to camp, the elders of Israel said, "Why did the Lord bring defeat upon us today before the Philistines? Let us bring the Ark of the Covenant from Shiloh so that it may go with us and save us from the hand of our enemies." The situation here is very simple. Israel is in combat with the Philistines. And the Philistines are this ferocious neighbor that lived to the southwest of Israeli territory. And the Philistines actually were not native to Canaan. They did not come from Canaan. For a long time, in fact, many people suspected that the Philistines were Phoenicians, that they had traveled down the coast from what is present-day Lebanon. However, recent archaeological finds indicate that they actually may have been Greek. That's a little bit of a surprise. But the Egyptian pharaoh had been involved in warfare with the Greeks, and the Egyptian pharaoh was Ramses III, and after he defeated them, he resettled them into what is present-day Israel. And we know that the Philistines potentially could have been European in origin because the few words that we know in the Philistine language have an Indo-European root. And also the earliest pottery which has been found in the Philistine cities are very similar to pottery found in Mycenae, which was an early Greek city-state. So it certainly was possible, and it leads credence to that theory that potentially they may have been Greek in origin. Personally, I think they probably were the forebears of the Irish. Because wherever you find the Philistines, you find them in conflict and in battle. Wherever you go in the Old Testament, they're always fighting. They always seem to be looking for a good fight. And being part Irish, I can say that and not be accused of being prejudiced. Anyways, Israel and the Philistines are in another battle. And the Israelites lose, 4,000 of their number are killed, and the elders ask, "What happened? How could we lose?" So they get this idea. They get this idea to bring the Ark of the Covenant from Shiloh so that it may lead us and so that it will save us from the hands of the enemy. So they send two people out to get the Ark. Now, I want to explain to you a little bit about what lies behind the Israelites' decision to get the ark. The ark is the most important piece of furniture found in the tabernacle. It's a rectangular box, about 1.1 meters in length, 70 centimeters across, and 70 centimeters deep. It is made out of acacia wood. It is covered with gold. And on its top, there is a, in some versions of the Bible, they call it the atonement cover. In the King James Version, they have a very romantic name. They call it the mercy seat. And in other versions of the Bible, they just call it the lid. And that lid, that atonement cover, is made out of pure gold, has two cherubim, or angels, at either end, and their wings meet and touch across the center of the cover of the ark. And the ark was the place where God said to Moses in Exodus 25, he said, "There I will meet with you, there I will speak to you, and there I will give you all my commands for the Israelites." And the ark represented God's presence among his people. So it was kept in the Holy of Holies, which was the inner sanctuary of the temple. And it was called the Holy of Holies because God was there. God was there, and his presence was symbolized by the ark. Now, the thinking of the Israelis or the Israelites is very, very simple. There were times in Israel's history when they had been in trouble, when their back had been up against the wall, that they had been in some kind of crisis, and they had brought the Ark of the Covenant out of the Holy of Holies, and they had brought it into the situation, and miracles had taken place. And it appeared the Ark seemed to have some type of power. For example, if you turn to Numbers 10, Israel is marching with the Ark in the front. And in verse 35, Moses says, "Rise up, O Lord, may your enemies be scattered, may your foes flee before you." And every time the ark was taken up, Moses would repeat this refrain. It was like a liturgy. In Joshua 3, verse 1, we have the Israelites embarking on their conquest of Canaan. And they come to the Jordan River. And the ark is leading them. And as the priest's feet touch the river Jordan, the water ceases to flow. And they take the ark to the middle of the river, and the Israeli nation marches past the ark onto the other side of the embankment, and the priests follow. And as they leave the dry riverbed, the Jordan River begins to flow again. And further on in Joshua, we see the city of Jericho, where Joshua tells the priests to march around the city for 7 days. And then on the seventh day, they march around 7 times. And they blow their trumpets, and the walls of the city collapse. So this is part of their thinking. This is part of their history. You have to understand what the Israelites thought. Where there is the ark, there is victory. So let's get the ark. The same ark where Moses would say, "Rise up, O Lord, may your enemies be scattered, may your foes flee before you. Let's take this ark into battle against the Philistines, and it will deliver us." So let's see what happened. Starting at verse 5. "When the ark of the Lord's covenant came into the camp, all Israel raised such a great shout that the ground shook. And hearing the uproar, the Philistines asked, 'What's all this shouting in the Hebrew camp?' And when they heard that the ark of the Lord had come into the camp, the Philistines were afraid. 'A god has come into the camp,' they said. 'We're in trouble. Nothing like this has happened before. Woe to us. Who will deliver us from the hand of these mighty gods? They are the gods who struck the Egyptians with all kinds of plagues in the desert. Be strong, Philistines. Be men, or you will be subject to the Hebrews as they have been to you. Be men and fight.' So the Philistines fought and the Israelites were defeated, and every man ran to his tent. The slaughter was very great. Israel lost 30,000 foot soldiers. The Ark of God was captured, and Eli's two sons, Hophni and Phinehas, died. What happened? What went wrong? They bring the Ark with them, the Ark which has a proven track record of success, and instead of victory, all is lost. They are defeated. 30,000 killed. Hophni and Phinehas die. The Ark is captured by the Philistines. Let's read on, because we'll come back to that question in a second. Starting at verse 12. That same day, a Benjamite ran from the battle line and went to Shiloh, his clothes torn and dust on his head. And when he arrived, there was Eli sitting on his chair by the side of the road, watching because his heart feared for the Ark of God. And when the man entered the town and told what had happened, the whole town sent up a cry. Eli heard the outcry and asked, "What is the meaning of this uproar?" And the man hurried over to Eli, who was 98 years old, and whose eyes were set so that he could not see. And he told Eli, "I have just come from the battle line. I fled from it this very day." Eli asked, "What happened, my son?" The man who brought the news replied, "Israel fled before the Philistines, and the army has suffered heavy losses. Also, your two sons, Hophni and Phinehas, are dead, and the Ark of God has been captured." And when he mentioned the Ark of God, Eli fell backward off of his chair by the side of the gate. His neck was broken, and he died. For he was an old man and heavy. By heavy, he means that he was fat. He had led Israel for 40 years. His daughter-in-law, the wife of Phinehas, was pregnant and near the time of delivery. And when she heard the news that the Ark of God had been captured and that her father-in-law and husband were dead, she went into labor and gave birth, but was to overcome and was overcome by her labor pains. And as she was dying, the woman attending her said, "Don't despair. You have given birth to a son." But she did not respond or pay any attention. She named the boy Ichabod, saying, "The glory has departed from Israel." Because of the capture of the Ark of God and the deaths of her father-in-law and husband, she said, "The glory has departed from Israel, for the Ark of God has been captured." This is a tragic story. It's a tragic story. We find Eli, he's waiting in Shiloh. He's waiting for news of a victory. And instead he discovers that Israel has been defeated. His two sons are killed. The Ark has been captured by the Philistines. He falls off his chair, breaks his neck. Phinehas' wife goes into premature labor, delivers a son. She dies in the process. But before she dies, names her son Ichabod. The glory of God has departed. At the end of chapter 4, there's only one member of Eli's family still alive. Ichabod. It's a tragic story. But it has its source in a very simple issue. I'm going to go back to Joshua 3:5. This is where the Israelites are crossing the River Jordan. And it's written in verse 5, "Joshua told the people, 'Consecrate yourselves, for tomorrow the Lord will do amazing things among you.'" So when they brought the ark to the cross the River Jordan, what did Joshua say to them? It's a very simple principle. The Lord will do amazing things among you. In the same chapter, in verse 10, it says, "This is how you will know that the living God is among you. and he will certainly drive out before you. The idea is simple. God will save you. In Joshua chapter 6 and verse 2, it says, "See," and this is God speaking, "I have delivered Jericho into your hands." And in verse 16, "Shout, for the Lord has given you the city." What's the principle here? It's God who goes before you. It's God who saves you. It's God who gives you victory. But if you turn to 1 Samuel chapter 4 and verse 3, and you read it very carefully, what does it say? "Let us bring the ark of the Lord's covenant from Shiloh so that it may go with us and save us from the hand of our enemies." There's a lot of "it" there, and there's a lot of "us," but there's no God. What they had done was, having detached the ark from God himself and putting their trust in the ark and not in God, they discovered that the ark was nothing more than a lifeless box. They sought to emulate the pattern behind the previous victories, but they forgot the principles. Yes, carry the ark, that's the pattern. But the principle is to trust in God, whom the ark represents. And when we reduce Christian living or Christian service to a pattern or to a program that does not require divine intervention, that does not require divine initiative, that does not require divine activity or divine originality, then we have killed it dead. And that is why we look to biblical principles, not to biblical patterns. You can imitate patterns, but the principle is not how something happens, but about why something happens. When the Israelites crossed the Jordan River, yes, they were carrying the ark, but the important thing is not how, but why. Because God intervened. But here in 1 Samuel, they had fetched the ark. They're repeating the pattern. They're copying what had been done before, believing it will save them, and it couldn't, and it doesn't. And you know, the history of the Christian church, as well as the people of God in the Old Testament, has shown that we need again and again and again to learn this lesson. You know, sometimes we hear that a revival has broken out somewhere else in the rest of the world. And what do? We get together our Christian journalists and our Christian strategists and our Christian photographers, and we get them on a plane and we fly them to where the revival is taking place, and they take their photographs and they take their notes and they return back and they reduce it to a seminar. And then they go around to the rest of the country giving a seminar on how to conduct a revival on something which happened in another part of the world. And what does God write across it? Ichabod. The glory of God has departed. Another church may be very successful in the community where you may live. So what do? They send some spies. You know? Let's go see why they're being successful and we're not being so successful. And what did they discover? They discover, oh, they don't have a choir anymore. They've decided to go with a worship band. So they come back and they emulate the pattern. They bring back a worship band into their church, but it doesn't work. So they send their spies back. And the spies return and they go, "We forgot to tell you." They repeat the song 12 times. You know? And God writes Ichabod. Or something God may have blessed years and years ago. And we believe it's a proven pattern that God blesses. For instance, 50 years ago in the city of Toronto, the Youth for Christ movement began. Many people came to Christ during that movement. However, I have to ask you, do you really believe that if you were to restart those rallies, that it would be as effective as what it was 50 years ago? It was 50 years ago. The pattern he blessed was something that happened 50 years ago. And we convince ourselves that by copying the pattern, it's a God-proven technique. And we try to emulate, and God writes Ichabod. We do this even in our personal lives. The gentleman who's a friend of mine once read the biography of C.T. Studd. C.T. Studd was a very famous British missionary. He was the founder of the Worldwide Evangelism Crusade movement. He served as a missionary in China and in India and in the Congo. And C.T. Studd used to get up at 3:30 every morning and pray for an hour. And according to his son-in-law, Norman Grubb, who was his biographer, he would never miss this, and that this was the secret of C.T. Studd's success and of his life. So what did my friend do? My friend turns around, he decides he's going to emulate C.T. Studd's prayer regimen. So he gets up at 3:30 in the morning, gets himself a cup of coffee. He's a little bit groggy, you know. He's not used to getting up at 3:30 in the morning. Grabs his Bible, puts it on the bed to his right, gets down on his knees, pulls out his prayer list, closes his eyes to pray, wakes up at 7 o'clock in the morning, tired and stiff, and in heaven they laughed because he had tried to repeat the pattern of C.T. Studd, thinking that the pattern was the same for everyone, and the angels wrote Ichabod. Now, listen to me. There is nothing wrong from learning from the movements of God. But when they become objects on which we depend, they become substitutes for God himself. And this is what happened here. The ark was a physical expression for the presence of God, but the moment they began to trust the ark itself, they discovered it was lifeless and that it had no intrinsic value or no intrinsic power. There is no intrinsic power in any form or in any methodology or in any pattern. There is only power in God himself. Have you ever wondered why? We can't lock Jesus into any pattern. You know, people have tried to do that. But you know, if you go and you read chapters 8 and 9 of the book of Matthew, you'll find that there are 10 separate miracles that are performed. Before those two chapters, we find Jesus teaching, but there are no miracles. But starting in chapter 8, we get miracle after miracle after miracle. And when you read those chapters, what you find is that, and what you discover is that the way Jesus performed his miracles varied. So, in the first miracle, there's a leper. Jesus reaches out, and he touches him, and the leper is cured. And the next miracle is a centurion. The centurion comes to Jesus, tells him about his servant's illness. Jesus tells him to return home. He returns home and discovers that his servant has been healed. Jesus never touched him. Jesus never saw him. You know, Jesus was never with him. In another case, there's a paralytic who is lowered down from the roof by his friends. And Jesus says to him, your sins are forgiven. Arise. And he just gets up and he walks away. In another case, there is a woman who had been bleeding for many, many years. He didn't touch her. She touched him. And she was immediately healed. And Jesus turned around and he asked, who had touched him? And she was embarrassed, but she confessed because she had been hemorrhaging for 12 years. We don't think too much about this. But if those people who were healed were anything like what we are today, when Jesus left the area, there would have been some difficulties. There would have been some difficulties. Let me take a little bit of license here, and I'm going to personalize this a little bit. Brad, where's Brad? Where is he? I know he's around here somewhere. Oh, he's next door right now. It's too bad. Anyway, Brad is there. Brad is our leper. He's been touched by God. He's been touched by Jesus. And he's been healed. And Chester, where's Chester? I saw him over there. Chester, right? Chester is the gentleman whose good friends had taken and lowered him through the roof. And he is a paralytic, had been paralytic since he was born. And God turned around, and Jesus turned around to him and said, "Rise, your sins are forgiven." And he was healed. So what happens is Brad and Chester get together and they start to share their testimony with one another. And Chester asks Brad, Brad asks Chester, "How did you feel when Jesus touched you?" And Chester goes, "Well, what do you mean?" And Brad says, "Well, you know, when he touched you. Didn't you feel that warmth travel through your body? I mean, couldn't you feel the power actually coming through his fingertips?" Chester says, "I don't know what you're talking about. He never touched me." "What do you mean he didn't touch you?" "He never touched me." "Well, how were you healed?" "He told me to get up. Take my mat." "You mean he never touched you?" "No, he just spoke to me. He just spoke to me." And being like what we are today, Brad and Chester could not reconcile their differences, their experiences with Christ. So what would happen? Brad would go out and he'd probably start his own church. Call it the touchy church. You know. Their favorite hymn is, "He touched me. To get a touch from the Lord is so real. He touched me." Meanwhile, in another part of the town, Chester creates his own church. It's the Church of the Word. A part of their liturgy, "Speak, Lord, in the stillness. We'll make sure it's still and wait on thee." Yeah. See the problem? You see the problem? They have based their beliefs upon their experience with Christ. And it just so happened several months later, my good friend Nick comes into town. He moves into town. Thank you, Nick. Nick comes into town. He, too, had been healed by Jesus. And coincidentally, Brad and Chester meet at Nick's house, both of them to convince him to come to their church. And Brad says to Nick, "Come to our church this Sunday. Share how Jesus touched you and you were healed." "What do you mean?" "Just tell us how you felt the Holy Spirit as filling you up as he touched you." "But Jesus never touched me." Right away, Chester jumps in, you know. "Nick, that's wonderful to know. Come to our church. We want to hear your testimony of how Jesus spoke to you and how you were healed." And Nick goes, "He never spoke to me. Jesus never spoke to me." And they both say, well, how are you healed?" "Well, he spat in my eyes. Do you remember that in Mark 8, verse 22 and 23? Jesus goes into a village. There's a blind man there. He takes him to the edge of the village. Now, you have to think of the scene. All these people are all standing around. The members of the touchy church are over here, and the members of the word church are over here. They're expecting either him to touch or for him to actually speak the word. And what do they get? Come on, you know? Nick probably has to go out and start his own church. The Church of the Holy Spittle. Their favorite song, "Spittle of the Living God, fall afresh on me." Yeah? A little bit of levity here. But the point I'm trying to make is the moment you reduce Christ in a predictable manner, he surprises you. But we don't like to be surprised, do we? We love to fit God into a pattern because if you simply repeat the pattern, you don't have to deal with God himself. All you have to do is perform. Big difference. The important thing was never how Jesus healed. The important thing was who healed. You never try to reproduce in yourself what God has done in somebody else because you will produce an Ichabod. And you never demand of others the same pattern of experience that God has given you because you will produce an Ichabod. What happened here in Samuel 4 was that they said, bring the ark, and it will go, and it will save us, and it couldn't, and it didn't. Israel was defeated, 30,000 are killed, Phinehas and Hophni are dead, Eli has broken his neck and has died, the wife of Phinehas has given birth and has died, and they are left with Ichabod. Ichabod. The glory of God has departed from Israel. What God blesses while expressing himself, he will condemn when it becomes a substitute for himself. I want to repeat that again. It's an important principle. What God blesses while expressing himself, he will condemn when it becomes a substitute for himself. In 2 Kings chapter 18, you read the story of Hezekiah. Hezekiah was a good king. It says in verse 3, he said, he did what was right. And what was right at that time was that he moved the Israelites away from pagan worship. And he had them destroy the Ashtaroth poles. He had them destroy the holy stones. He had them destroy the high places. And if we had been there, we would have been cheering him on. Go, Hezekiah! Go, Hezekiah! And then he did something really weird. Really strange. He broke into pieces the bronze snake that Moses had made. Now, if you go back into Leviticus, you'll see that there was a bronze snake that Moses had created because the Israelites in the desert were being plagued by poisonous serpents. And if they were to look upon that bronze snake and had faith, they would be saved. And yet Hezekiah turns around and destroys it. This is something that the Israelites had kept for 500 years. And he destroys it. Why? Well, if you read, you see that the Jews were burning incense to it. They had taken something that God had given to them, and they were burning incense to it. It had become a substitute for God, and Hezekiah rightfully and correctly broke it into pieces. Goes on a little bit further. In the book of Amos, chapter 5, 21, this is God speaking. He says, I despise your religious feasts. I cannot stand your assemblies. Even though you bring me burnt offerings and grain offerings, I will not accept them. Though you bring choice fellowship offerings, I have no regard for them. You see, they were no longer a means to communicate with God. They had all become an it, a pattern, that they had forgotten what they were worshiping. And God will despise those things that become a substitute for himself. It goes on a little bit further. It says, away with the noise of your songs. I will not listen to the music of your harps. He's talking about the psalms that they are singing. And God is saying, I don't want to hear them. Why? Because it was no longer a means to communicate with God. It was a means to express themselves. The songs had become an it. Now I'm going to go on a little bit. I'm going to read in chapter 5 what happens to the ark when the Philistines get it. It starts, says, after the Philistines had captured the ark of God, they took it from Ebenezer to Ashdod. And then they carried the ark into Dagon's temple and they set it beside Dagon. Dagon was the principal god of the Philistines in Ashdod. And when the people of Ashdod rose early the next day, there was Dagon fallen on his face on the ground before the ark of the Lord. They took Dagon fallen on his face on the ground before the ark of the Lord. They put him back in his place, but the following morning when they rose, there was Dagon fallen on his face on the ground before the ark. His head and his hands were broken off, and they were lying on the threshold. Only his body remained. That is why to this day, neither the priests of Dagon nor any others who enter Dagon's temple at Ashdod step on the threshold. And if you follow those verses further, they elaborate on the difficulties that the Philistines have with the Ark of the Covenant in their midst. And it gets to the point that the Ark is being passed around from Philistine city to Philistine city like a hot potato. Because wherever it went, the Philistines were plagued by disease and they were plagued by tumors. Now, I find this interesting. Why? I find it interesting because God honored amongst the pagans what he refused to honor among his own people who should have known better. He honored the Philistines with his presence. Among his own people, the ark was an it which had no power. But amongst the Philistines, God revealed his presence to them because the ark did represent his presence. And in chapter 6, the Philistines decide they've had enough of God's presence. And they put the ark into a cart, and the cart goes back into Israeli territory, and the ark is returned to the Israelis. Now, there's a couple of interesting stories when it first returns to the Israelis. The ark came back and it returned to a place called Beth Shemesh. And when it returned, the people were overjoyed to see the return of the ark. And they were so overjoyed that they forgot that there were certain rules about dealing with the ark. And in the process, what they did was that some looked into the ark. And that was a death sentence. In some versions of the Bible, it says 50,700 die. In other versions, it says 70 die. I tend to believe the 70 died, not the 50,000 died. But whatever the case may be, there is an important lesson here that we need to understand. And that lesson is this. If we approach God other than on the basis of shed blood. You got to remember that when the high priest would go into the Holy of Holies, he would only do so once a year after the proper sacrifices had been made. So he was entering there on the basis of shed blood. So if you approach God other than on the basis of shed blood, you do not meet God as a friend. You meet him as our judge. It's a very, very different perspective. And it may sound harsh, but this is why Jesus had to die for us. Jesus was an atoning sacrifice, atoning for our sin. And without his blood sacrifice, God has no option but to be our judge. Now, this is interesting, because after the ark returns, and after this tragedy that takes place with the 70 that are killed, we find in chapter 7 that the men of Kiriath Jearim go to Beth Shemesh, and they pick up the ark, and they take it to the house of Abinadab, and they consecrate Abinadab's son, Eleazar, to guard the ark of the Lord. And that is where the ark stayed for the next 20 years. In the house of Abinadab, guarded by Eleazar. And over that 20-year period, we begin to see a difference in attitude among the Israelites. So in chapter 7 and verse 2, it's written, "And all the people mourned and sought after the Lord." Well, that's a different attitude. It's no longer it that will save. Now they mourn and they seek after the Lord. In verse 3, Samuel says, "Commit yourself to the Lord and serve him only, and he will deliver you out of the hand of the Philistines." That's a new attitude. God is going to deliver you. Then in verse 8, the Israeli people say to Samuel, "Do not stop crying to the Lord our God for us, that he may rescue us from the hand of the Philistines." That's different. They were not saying that before. Before it was it that would deliver them. Now it is he. God will deliver us from the hand of the Philistines. And so Samuel cried out to the people, to God on the people's behalf. And then in the middle of verse 10, we read, "That day the Lord thundered with loud thunder against the Philistines and threw them into such a panic that they were routed before the Israelites. And the men of Israel rushed out of Mizpah and pursued the Philistines, slaughtering them along the way to a point below Beth-Kar." Verse 12, "Then Samuel took a stone and set it up between Mizpah and Shen. He named it Ebenezer, saying, 'Thus far the Lord has helped us.'" So the Philistines were subdued, and they did not invade Israelite territory again. And throughout Samuel's lifetime, Israelite territory was not invaded again by the Philistines. So what is happening is this. They're crying out for the Lord to save them. Samuel is encouraging them to worship the Lord, for he will deliver them. And they say to Samuel, "Don't stop crying out to God for us." And God did intervene, and God did rescue them. And they end up building a little memorial stone, which they called Ebenezer. "Thus far, the Lord has helped us." Now today, we've learned two Hebrew words. Ichabod. The glory of God has departed Israel. Israel's been defeated. 30,000 are dead. Hophni and Phinehas have died. Eli's fallen off his chair, broken his neck. His daughter-in-law has died birth, but before she dies, she names her son Ichabod. The glory of God has departed. And Ebenezer is the second word that we have learned. Hitherto, this is one interpretation, hitherto the Lord has done it, or thus far the Lord has helped us. And when we plead to him and we cry out to him, then God will give us victory. God does. So I ask you in closing today, which of these two words accurately represents your life? Is it Ichabod? I do all the right things, but there is no power, there's no victory, there's no fruitfulness, it's just all human activity. Or is it Ebenezer? God has done it. And God is doing it. My trust is not in any it. It's not in any pattern or a program or in methodology. It's not in any person. These all may be helpful, but my trust is in God and is in God alone. And as you trust God, he intervenes and he will work in your life. You see, the theme here is beyond superficiality. It's beyond dealing with the externals. We might deal with God himself. The question is it Ichabod, the glory has departed? Or is it Ebenezer, the Lord has done it? The life we have been invited to by our Lord Jesus is a life that can only be explained in terms of what Jesus is doing in you and through you. It will not be explained by anything we are doing for him. And it is when the Israelites have been brought to that point of saying to Samuel, keep crying out to the Lord that he will rescue us. Because we know we cannot save ourselves. That it's not in us. That it's God himself. And that is the key to avoiding superficiality. That is the key to walking in a relationship with the Lord that is living, that is fresh, and that is fruitful every day. Does that make sense? Next week we'll take up a little bit more on superficiality. Thank you. I'm going to ask the worship team to come up and join us. And as they're coming up, I'm going to just a little prayer, if I can find it. Let's bow our heads to pray for a second, please. If I can find it. I pray, dear Father, that you be with us, that you guide us in everything that we do, that you allow us to pursue a life that acknowledges your workings in us, helps us to become a sacrifice for you. Do not allow us to become hardened. Allow us to open up our hearts so that you may be able to work within us. Allow us not to lose our sensitivity. Allow us to remain pure in all that we do. We pray for this in the name of your Son, Jesus Christ. Amen.